Welcome to this episode of our special podcast series, a collaboration between ASTCT Talks and Cancer Network. In each episode, we dive into the latest developments and challenges in the treatment of multiple myeloma, T-cell malignancies, and other pivotal topics in oncology, hematology, stem cell transplantation, and cellular therapy. Join us as we speak with leading experts, uncover new research insights, and tackle key issues facing healthcare professionals today. For this special collaborative episode between Oncology on the Go and ASTCT Talks, our guests include expert pharmacist Alexis Kuhn of Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, Katie Bruce of Sarah Cannon in Nashville, Tennessee, and Susie Long of the University of Minnesota Masonic Children's Hospital. The conversation focused on ensuring quality care across all treatment stages with the use of FDA-approved gene therapies for patients with sickle cell disease and other hemoglobinopathies.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to this podcast, which is a collaboration between ASTC Talks and Oncology on the Go for our Pharmacy Week podcast, where today we'll be discussing gene therapies from the pharmacy perspective. My name is Alexis Kuhn, and I'm a pediatric hemonc BMT pharmacist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and an assistant professor of pediatrics and pharmacy at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. And today, I have the pleasure to be joined by two fantastic colleagues, Dr. Katie Bruce and Dr. Susie Long, for a thrilling discussion on what's certainly going to be a very exciting and developing area of medicine. I will be serving as your moderator today throughout our discussion, where we're going to primarily focus on the ex vivo gene therapies that have been approved for the hemoglobinopathies, including those that use gene editing and lentiviral gene transfer. Since we want to highlight the aspects of care relevant to our transplant and cellular therapy pharmacists, we won't be delving into the in vivo gene therapies like those that were approved for hemophilia. However, we will be diving into the pharmacy relevant aspects of these ex vivo gene therapies through the eyes and extensive hands-on experience of Drs. Bruce and Long. To get us started, Dr. Bruce, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself and gene editing?
Absolutely. Thanks, Alexis. My name is Katie Bruce, and I am the Pediatric Clinical Pharmacy Specialist at Sarah Cannon Research Pediatric Oncology and our stem cell program here in Nashville, Tennessee. Our center, we have been involved with the research trials behind the exa-cel product, which is now commercially known as Casgevy. It is currently indicated for use in patients with sickle cell disease and patients with transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia. We are lucky to have been the institution where the very first patient in the world received the exa-cel infusion, and her name is Victoria Gray, and you can follow her story on various news outlets. She had crippling sickle cell disease, and she will tell you that this therapy changed her life. We have infused over 40 patients at our institution on the various trials that helped Casgevy get FDA approval in December of 2023. A little bit about gene editing, and I just wanted to make sure we touched on this before kind of going forward. Exa-cel is a non-viral autologous cell therapy that is designed to reactivate fetal hemoglobin production by means of ex vivo clustered, regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats, or CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing at the erythroid enhancer region of BCL11A in a patient's own hematopoietic stem and progenitor cells. BCL11A has been identified as the transcription factor that represses the expression of fetal hemoglobin, meaning that it turns off the production of fetal hemoglobin. There have been studies that have shown that higher levels of fetal hemoglobin are associated with reduced morbidity and mortality in both sickle cell patients and beta thalassemia patients. So the idea was hypothesized that if fetal hemoglobin and total hemoglobin are increased in these patients, it would have the potential to decrease vaso-occlusive events in sickle cell patients and decrease the need for transfusions in beta thalassemia patients by the gene-edited cells increasing overall fetal hemoglobin in these patients.
Nice. That was an excellent intro into today's topic. Thank you so much, Katie. I'm so excited to dive a little further into your wealth of knowledge and experience with XSL and gene editing. But first, we're also, of course, joined by Dr. Susie Long. Dr. Long, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself and lentiviral gene transfer?
Thank you, Alexis. My name is Susie Long, and I'm a pharmacist with the BMT and Cellular Therapy team at the University of Minnesota Masonic Children's Hospital. At Minnesota, we have clinical trial experience with several gene therapies and are currently in the process of delivering our first FDA-approved products as well. In the clinical trials that we've been involved with, that includes ex vivo gene editing for sickle cell and beta thal that Katie just discussed. We've also participated in studies using the zinc finger nuclease-based approaches, as well as gene therapies that utilize the lentiviral vector transfer. And those are the FDA-approved products that we have here at Minnesota right now. So a little more about lentiviral vector transfer. It's a technique that uses modified lentiviruses to deliver therapeutic genes into an individual's own stem cells. So the patient's stem cells are collected via apheresis, sent off to a manufacturing site. We all know that viruses are great at getting into cells. So these viruses are used as a vector to insert or transduce the therapeutic gene into the patient's own stem cells to treat their underlying genetic disorder. These lentiviruses are engineered to safely carry the specific genes without causing any viral disease. After the gene therapy is infused back into the patient, the genetically modified stem cells engraft into the bone marrow. They repopulate and they go on to differentiate into cells that express the functional protein that they were originally lacking. As a result, the patient now has an endogenous source of that previously missing protein. So for hemoglobinopathies, the lentiviral vector use contains genetic material to produce a functional beta globulin gene, which after engraftment and differentiation leads to the production of the beta globulin expressing erythroblasts. And basically, this means the individual will now produce functionally normal red blood cells. For other conditions like adrenoleukodystrophy, which is also called ALD, or metachromatic leukodystrophy, MLD, these gene therapies are produced with a similar process. The modified stem cells are then infused back into the patient. After engraftment, the stem cells actually will cross the blood-brain barrier and they differentiate into microglial cells in the central nervous system. And these cells then provide a source of the functional protein that are lacking, respective to those specific genetic diseases. So this approach offers some promising new treatment options for these rare genetic diseases.
All right, that was awesome. Thank you so much, Susie. Now, you both mentioned that these therapies are autologous cell products using the patient's own hematopoietic stem and progenitor cells. But of course, before we even get to the apheresis part, especially for these hemoglobinopathy therapies, there are important medication considerations with recommendations for both XSL and lovo-cel to hold those sickle cell modifying therapies like hydroxyurea, crizanlizumab, and voxelotor for at least 8 weeks beforehand. Susie, how do you guys approach the apheresis preparations in your practice?
So at Minnesota, in the time leading up to apheresis, patients will have a series of appointments to prepare for the apheresis step of their gene therapy process. One of these appointments is with a pharmacist. During this appointment, the pharmacist will review the gene therapy candidate's current medication list. We'll specifically look for medications that may interfere with the manufacturing process for gene therapy. So for hemoglobinopathy, but these, like you mentioned, we'll ask them to hold medications like hydroxyurea. The exact amount of days depends on the product, so you have to pay special attention to that when we're counseling them. And in the meantime, if they do need bridging for low hemoglobin, we will bridge with transfusions. Additionally, it's important to note that with the lentiviral product, the lentiviral vector gene therapies, they also need to stop any antiretrovirals at least 1 month prior to apheresis.
Like Dr. Long here at my center, we often do need to hold certain medications prior to the apheresis mobilization process. We usually, right now, most of our patients have been on a trial, so we follow the trial protocol very closely. Most of the time, this includes holding hydroxyurea and other sickle cell medications at least 2 weeks before their initial screening, and then at least 8 weeks before mobilization and apheresis, then at least 8 weeks before busulfan prep. In both our other patients, our beta thal patients and our sickle cell patients, if they are on any kind of chelation, we do stop this at least 7 days prior to busulfan prep.
Nice. Those are awesome perspectives. Thank you both so much. So now, once a patient has held their therapies for the requisite period of time, as you review with the patients beforehand, of course, it's time for apheresis. And I think it's safe to say here, apheresis in the context of these gene therapies is a little unique as compared to, say, an autologous or a conventional auto transplant patient. Katie, can you expand on some of these unique considerations relative to the apheresis process?
Absolutely. One important element to note that is a little bit different than how we collect other autologous patients is that with our patients with sickle cell disease, we are mobilizing with plexaflor only, and we are not using filgrastim. There is evidence out there that filgrastim could potentially increase the risk for a vaso-occlusive pain crisis, and we are trying to avoid that in our sickle cell patients. Because we are using only plexaflor, the timing is a little bit different. And again, it has been dictated by our research protocol. But usually, the plexaflor is actually given 4 to 6 hours prior to the collection, which is a notable deviation from the FDA labeling that specifies administration approximately 11 hours prior to each apheresis session. So this adds logistical complications because we no longer really give it outpatient. We have admitted patients to be able to give them the plexaflor at the 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock in the morning time frame, depending on their apheresis session. But thankfully, now that plexaflor is generic, I think that this is going to make it a little bit easier to provide inpatient administration now that the products are commercially available.
So Katie raises some good points, and those have a large focus on us as well. I do want to note, though, when we're using the non-sickle cell gene therapies, we still do use filgrastim in addition to plexaflor for mobilization. So just like when we have an autologous transplant patient, there's a lot of challenges in getting the filgrastim covered outpatient that I just want to point out because this is a pain point for our team and probably similar experiences with others. But just the pure way that the filgrastim is covered by insurance can be a challenge. Sometimes it's through the infusion center pharmacy, sometimes it's via retail or via home infusion. So we also have to figure out who and how, where the filgrastim will be administered. Will the patient family do it themselves, or do they need to come in to our infusion center? If that's the case, is there any clear bagging or white bagging that has to be considered based on their insurance? Or is there a home infusion situation where they can get the product at home? So everyone's insurance is different, and so every patient, there's a unique new plan that gets figured out. So my advice is figuring out this plan well in advance and have really good, clear communication with many members of your team of what the plan is.
Nice. Spoken like a true veteran pharmacist over here. Katie, do you have anything else to add from your perspective?
I agree with what Susie was saying, and I do want to also highlight that when you have patients with beta thalassemia where you're going to use filgrastim to help with mobilization, their dose can be dependent based off of whether or not they've had a splenectomy. If they have their spleen, we'll do twice daily filgrastim dosing, but if they have had a splenectomy, we will stick with the 5 mics per kilo once a day. This can also, to tag onto what Susie was saying, can offer some challenges if you have someone getting twice daily dosing that needs to come to your infusion center, making sure that you have time to be able to give both of their doses in.
And then another consideration that I wanted to mention here is that some of our patients require multiple collections in order to get enough cells for both the manufacturing process and also if they need a backup collection in the event of engraftment failure. So if a patient doesn't collect enough cells with one mobilization or apheresis cycle, they will need to wait at least 2 weeks. At our institution, we even perform 4 weeks between these mobilization apheresis cycles. So this process starts to get more prolonged for them. In addition to that, our institution has to work with the manufacturing site to make sure that they actually have a slot, a manufacturing slot to receive the slot cells and process them on their end as well. So these are all different things that have to be coordinated throughout this process. At our institution, we do have more chat. Challenges with the sickle cell patients collecting with just one cycle, but for the other genetic diseases, we almost are always able to collect or make our collection goals with just one cycle.
Agree. We've had a similar experience here where our beta thalassemia patients usually collect with one cycle. But our sickle cell patients, again, I think probably having to do with the fact that we're using D-PLEX4 only for mobilization, often require multiple collection cycles to be able to achieve the target dose that we need.
Wow, these are incredible points. Thank you both so much for sharing your experience here. So now you've gone through all this trouble of collecting these cells, and they need to be shipped off for manufacturing, as you both mentioned. Susie, can you shed some light on this next step of the process with, I guess, shipping off to the manufacturer?
Yeah, so there's a couple things to mention with the manufacturing process that I think you learn to appreciate as you go through this more. But one key item that could be very underappreciated if you're new to this topic is that once we start collecting the cells, the clock starts to tick, and we already have a limited amount of time to get those cells to the manufacturing site in order for them to be processed appropriately. Generally, that time frame is either 24 to 72 hours. So that depends on the manufacturing technique. For LVV, we're able to send all the cells at once at the end of our collection, but we still, when we start apheresis to when the manufacturing site receives the cell, that has to be in less than 72 hours. With the gene editing base, we send out cells every evening to those manufacturers. So that is the big kick or the big need for the plerixafor mobilization is that you get a real like big response. The other thing I want to mention is we're limited by the days of the week manufacturers will receive the cells. So we typically admit on Monday. If they're a sickle cell patient, they'll get an exchange transfusion on Monday. On Tuesday, they'll have their first collection. On Wednesday, they'll have a second if needed. Then at that point, their cells are processed by cell lab and shipped off in the allotted time window. And then on Thursday and Friday, they would get backup collection and those cells stay on site and stored at our cell therapy lab. Katie, do you have a similar process?
Yes, so we do have a very similar process. We use our standard to always admit on Sunday. Our sickle cell patients would get an exchange transfusion if needed on the Friday before. And then we admit on Sunday and collect on Monday and Tuesday, usually for manufacturing. And again, depending on which product you're doing and where you're sending it, you just need to pay attention to what your time frame is. And then they'll collect on Wednesday for backup cells. As Susie mentioned, it's important, and it is a requirement that we have some cells that we keep here for our patients to have that will freeze as a backup just in case that actually don't go for manufacturing. In our experience so far with exa-cel, manufacturing can take up to 8 to 10 weeks. I would say a minimum of 8 weeks. But it can be much longer before you can get those cells back and ready to infuse the patient. So I think it's important for the patients to understand that this process does take a little bit of time.
Yeah, for the LVV products, same. The manufacturing timeline can be between 50 and 90 days. For the leukodystrophy products. Those the manufacturer really do prioritize these products. They try their best to keep it that 50-day window or end of the time range, since we know that time is of the essence for these individuals to limit the progression of their disease.
Awesome. Thank you both. So now, once your centers do receive those cells back, I think the pharmacists in the audience are probably wondering who's handling this product. Is it housed within the pharmacy or your cell lab or somewhere else?
This is a great question. And for us, our cell therapy lab will be housing the drug now that it is commercially available. I say drug loosely. We will treat it very similar to our other IEC products, where it will be entered as a drug order in the EMR, and the pharmacy will provide labels for the product at bedside.
We have a similar situation here at the University of Minnesota, like Sarah Cannon. We have a strong cell therapy lab. So when it came time to determine how all the cellular and gene therapies would be managed or handled, actually, it just made sense not to recreate the wheel, and our cell therapy lab handles these products. However, for the commercially available products, we do enter an order in our electronic health record. The pharmacy labels adhere to the product prior to administration and appears on the MAR for charting. At Minnesota, the cost of the commercially available product falls under the inpatient pharmacy cost center. But I have heard from other institutions, they've actually created a separate cost center just for these products so that the pharmacy budget doesn't have these real wide fluctuations, skewing their like month-to-month normal budget. I think it is important to note there are pharmacies, inpatient pharmacies, that are taking the responsibility of handling these cellular gene therapy products. It does require a significant effort from the institution and the pharmacy to ensure they have all the proper equipment, meeting regulatory requirements, SOPs, and then proper education for their staff.
Sort of, on this topic, Susie, as we were preparing for this, you found this great article. So just to mention here, if any folks in the audience are looking for further reading on the topic of getting their pharmacies ready for cellular therapy site readiness, Dr. Martino and colleagues recently published their experience in a review published in the Journal of Oncology Pharmacy Practice earlier this summer. So if you would like a read further, that would be a great one. So now, once those cells are back at your treatment center, it's almost time to start conditioning. As was the case pre-apheresis, for both of these agents, there's recommendations for holding certain meds for a period of time prior to conditioning. How do you both handle this part of the process?
At Minnesota, a pharmacist meets with every patient prior to the start of conditioning for any stem cell product, cellular therapy, or gene therapy. So we have a regular visit with every patient. We go over their current meds, review allergies, we assess any concerns for medication access or adherence barriers. And then we take this time to review any drug interactions. So in the case of gene therapy, we'll look at our hemoglobinopathy patients. We would want to discontinue chelators for Hurler syndrome. They will discontinue their enzyme replacement therapy prior to gene therapy starting and conditioning. So our pharmacists really enhance the patient and family experience and preparedness by also providing extensive education on chemo. And then we review all the medications that we expect that they'll get for supportive care, both during the conditioning time, but also post gene therapy as well. After I meet with them, and I also meet with the doctor if there's any like drug dosing changes that need to be considered. And we plan that the reason for that is that we like to have our plan set up well in advance of admission or the start of conditioning.
Similarly, we always I sit down with all of the patients prior to admission in the week before during their eval period, and we discuss also the same thing, preconditioning. Most of our patients at this point will have already started to hold their chelation, which is like Susie mentioned. And we will also just sit down and review drug interactions. One of the big things that I usually remind patients of, as we'll talk about a little bit more with busulfan, but since busulfan prep is always a part of this, I remind them of the medications that could interact with busulfan, specifically acetaminophen. We would like to hold that prior to getting busulfan. And so I think this is important to think about with your sickle cell patients because they often have combo pain medications that do contain acetaminophen, and it's important to hold those at this point. Also, I think it's really important to note in the preconditioning counseling session is really explaining chemotherapy busulfan in a way that can make it very relatable to a patient who has never received chemotherapy. I think we get very used to counseling, especially pre-transplant, in patients who have had chemotherapy forever. One of the questions that I get probably the most from my sickle cell patients or my beta thalassemia patients before receiving chemotherapy is, when am I going to lose my hair, or how quickly will my hair fall out? And a lot of questions about nausea and vomiting, and that seems to be the things that make them the most concerned. And I feel like with our cancer patients, those things are, they've already lost their hair most of the time, and they are used to the nausea and vomiting, and they can usually tell you the regimen that works for them. So that's something that's really different about counseling, and sometimes that I have to really remind myself, these patients have never received chemotherapy before. One other thing to note is that during your pre-eval, you might want to, with our sickle cell patients, figure out what their pain regimen is, what pain medications have worked for them in the past, and kind of helping just so you have a really good understanding and can work with your team to come up with a pain plan for the future.
These are amazing perspectives. Thank you both so much. So now that you've had this pre-conditioning workup and they've held their meds and it's finally time to get to conditioning. Now, as you both mentioned, all of these hemoglobinopathy products do employ myeloablative busulfan monotherapy conditioning. So again, we're going to say that one more time: monotherapy myeloablative busulfan. This is obviously a little bit atypical from most of our busulfan-containing regimens. Susie, how does your center handle this step of the process?
So we utilize Bayesian dose modeling prior for our initial doses of busulfan, and then we have drug analysis on site that performs our performs in-house busulfan testing. So we're able to get our levels back same day. Our BMT pharmacists are responsible for making the therapeutic drug monitoring calculations, again using Bayesian modeling. And then we give those recommendations back to the attending physician if any dose changes are needed. At this time, for gene therapy, we're doing TDM on day 1, 2, and 3 to adjust the dose any days if needed to meet that goal AUC, the cumulative goal AUC. We did just conduct a little in-house analysis to see how our performance of our modeling is going, how accurate it is to do the per like. Predict the initial dose plus the future doses. And based on that, we'll be lightening our requirements in the future, the near future. Our standard for seizure prophylaxis is levetiracetam. We start the night before busulfan, and it continues till the day after. And then for VOD prophylaxis, we use ursodiol as a standard. We don't uniformly add defibrotide prophylaxis for gene therapy patients just based on diagnosis, but we would add it if they met our very high risk criteria.
So I'll have to say I am a little jealous that you get to do your pharmacokinetics in-house. We do not. We send our busulfan pharmacokinetics out to Seattle. So because of this, and because of how it takes a little bit longer for us to get levels back, we do utilize Q6-hour dosing of busulfan for all of our patients who are receiving gene-edited cells. We check our pharmacokinetic levels on day 1 and on day 3. And often collect day 2 levels because if you are at an institution that has to send levels out, I have done this long enough that you never know what might happen to your busulfan levels, including FedEx losing them, not enough dry ice, there's a storm, you name it. Our busulfan first day levels have gotten lost before. And so we always collect on day two to be able to send those if something happens with our day one. We also use levetiracetam for our seizure prophylaxis in all patients. We do start this just a couple of days before admission to kind of load them up and make sure that they have the levetiracetam in their system prior to starting busulfan. For VOD prophylaxis, like Susie, we use our institution does use ursodiol, and we also have not adopted the defibrotide prophylaxis. We have only had one patient at our institution who was part of the beta thalassemia trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine that required the use of defibrotide treatment. Of note that that study found that 5 of the 52 patients in beta thalassemia group developed veno-occlusive disease, and it was grade 3 or lower, and that resolved with defibrotide treatment in all of those patients. In the sickle cell study, only one patient out of 42 developed VOD and also responded to defibrotide treatment.
Awesome. Yeah, I will say, I guess like Susie, I'm a little bit spoiled. Here we have the luxury of in-house busulfan levels, and can do our Q24 conditioning with the Bayesian modeling. So a little spoiled, but helpful to have that perspective of other centers that don't have that luxury. So thank you both. So now, we mentioned seizure prophylaxis and VOD prophylaxis, but what about infectious prophylaxis? Of course, these patients are receiving myeloablative doses of busulfan and have to wait for these new cells to engraft. So during that period, they are going to be at high risk for infections. And this, as pharmacists, could be a great avenue for pharmacists to engage with their practices and develop site-specific SOPs to govern this infectious prophylaxis strategy. How do each of your centers handle infectious prophy?
So, Alexa, I think that this is a great question about our infectious prophylaxis. We kind of treat these patients per our protocols more similar to an autologous transplant, but we sometimes are maybe even a little bit more protective because they do get this myeloablative busulfan. So we start antibacterial prophylaxis with levofloxacin from the time they have their central line until our ANC drops to less than 500. And then our standard is to start cefepime until count recovery. We then restart levofloxacin around day 60 until around day 60 when our central line is removed. We will change most of these patients to amoxicillin prophylaxis until around 1 year post-transplant. For our antifungal prophylaxis, we start mycophungin in-house around day zero or around the day of cell infusion. We will transition to oral fluconazole around discharge and plan to stop it around line removal. At around day 60, we did have a few patients who experienced some thrush right after we stopped around day 60. So most of our patients now stay on it till around that 3 month mark or that 90 days post infusion. For PJP prophylaxis, we do kind of follow what we do in our normal transplant patients, where we do a quote unquote Bactrim load, where they get Bactrim daily during the first couple of days, and then we hold Bactrim since it can cause immune suppression and suppress counts. We hold it and then restart it around day 30, and we'll give that until around the 1 year mark. And then we use either valacyclovir or acyclovir prophylaxis for both HSV and VZV prevention. And we start on admission for those patients, and we do continue for around the 1 year mark, mainly to help prevent varicella reactivation in the form of shingles.
Yeah, infection and prophylaxis is a significant variation, I think, for gene therapy. It's definitely an area with evolving guidance because we're just starting to understand the infectious risk factors for our patients as well as their immune reconstitution. The International Society for Cell and Gene Therapy has published recommendations for infection prophylaxis and vaccinations. But it's important to remember that this is a survey-based guideline. So think of it more of an expert consensus guideline. guidance with a little bit of evidence-based sprinkled in. At Minnesota, we generally prophylax our patients for gene therapy in a similar manner as the autologous patients. Our standard for antibacterial prophylaxis is also levofloxacin. We start with conditioning and then we discontinue it once our patient has engrafted. We'll only transition to using a penicillin if the patient's asplenic. For fungal prophylaxis, we use fluconazole with starting on admission for conditioning. We stop that at day 60. And then patients are placed on antiviral prophylaxis if they have appropriate risk factors. And we generally stop that at day 60. But I will note there's a difference definitely there between our adult group and our peds group. Our adult group would keep that on for an entire year for the prevention of zoster. Where in the peds area, we really don't see zoster very often, and it's less of a concern for us. As for PJP prophylaxis, once our patients are engrafted, we start Bactrim and we only continue it until their CD4 count is over 200. At that point, it's discontinued.
Awesome. This is incredibly useful to hear these perspectives. Thank you both so much for sharing. And thank you, Susie, for mentioning that expert consensus. Yeah, I'm going to have to go find that after this talk here. So now, aside from the VOD that Katie previously mentioned, are there any other unique busulfan toxicities that you all have appreciated in this setting?
One interesting thing that we have observed in this population, who first, like I mentioned before, have generally never seen chemotherapy, and also they're only getting busulfan monotherapy as their conditioning. There does seem to be a little bit of a delay of onset of some of the more typical busulfan toxicities, including cytopenias and mucositis. So it's really interesting when we're explaining it to patients, when I'm doing education. They kind of have almost this 1 week where they actually feel fine in between busulfan and when their counts actually start to drop. We don't actually see their counts drop until about 8 to 10 days after the busulfan has finished. Then they start to get mucositis and the cytopenias and fevers and the things that kind of go along with what we traditionally think of with our transplant patients. So it's a really interesting thing to kind of see this like push. This delay of onset of symptoms. For our patients with sickle cell disease, like I mentioned before, they are often have a pain medication plan that works for them. And I do think that as pharmacists, this is where we can help optimize their care. And as I mentioned, I usually sit down with my team or on rounds daily, we talk about the pain and what has worked for those sickle cell patients before so that I can establish a plan for if we need to start a PCA or a pain pump for these patients and helping us guide where do we start and what kind of pain meds they might need to help them through this mucositis.
This is something we do review with the patients at the pre-transplant pharmacy appointment. I would say our experience here is very similar with that delay onset until they're starting to feel the toxicities of busulfan. We discuss with them, they're going to have low blood counts, they're going to need transfusions, there's an increased risk of infection, mucositis, and then treatment-related nausea. And those with sickle cells, we do take some time to talk about how mucositis pain is going to be different than pain they've experienced in the past. Typically, the anxieties are still there for them when it comes to starting to feel pain. And so there's definitely a large balance in dosing and frequency dosing and the agents being used during that time compared to what I would have used for a patient that's getting a stem cell transplant. So overall, our approach to pain management is different here. Pre-gene therapy, if they're a patient that comes from our own institution, our hematologist manages their pain. And if they're coming from a referring institution, like I can't really comment on that, but it's varying level of micromanagement by a healthcare provider depending per patient when they first come to us. Once they're admitted to our care, we take a multidisciplinary approach. We include our integrative therapy team, our psychology team, and then the adult pain team. When the patient discharges from the hospital, our BMT, APP, or docs continue to manage their pain in the clinic setting. And I was just talking about this with our main gene therapy sickle cell physician yesterday, but he noted that to date, our sickle cell patients are off opioids by day 60, which is pretty incredible. So that is the way that our team takes approach to help support these patients through this time with their pain management.
Wow, yeah, that is truly awesome. Is there anything else notable about the post-infusion period that you think would be valuable to add for our audience today?
As with so many other areas of medicine, the psychosocial support is crucial for these patients. Even after they have experienced recovery of all the acute side effects from conditioning. For many of these patients, the gene therapy products will give them a radical change from their pre-infusion lives. For the patients with sickle cell disease, they hopefully have a drastically reduced vaso-occlusive crisis from baseline. And for those with beta thal, they might be able to go without having to go to the clinic for transfusions as frequently as they did before. So I think it's really important to make sure that you have social work, psychology involved to be able to help them in the transition from not just the acute side effects of chemotherapy, but when you start to think more long term, because their lives do change so radically that they do need the support of people helping them come up with a different plan, to be able to look at their life in a different way now that they are not required to be in the hospital or in clinic quite as often.
That is so true. For our sickle cell patients, they have a new lease on life, but it's very abrupt and it really takes them some time to process that. They've never really had a long-term plan before because most of these patients were told they would probably pass away by the time they were 30 or 40 years old. So now that's completely different. So for our institution, after they transition out of the care of our team, we partner with the Minnesota Sickle Cell Foundation for long-term community transition and social support. In terms of patients that get lentiviral vector, that aren't, not all of them are sickle patients, but I just had a couple things that I wanted to touch on. And with these LVV products, the use of filgrastim after we infuse the product isn't needed, and we don't use it routinely. In fact, for some of them, it's not recommended for a certain amount of time. So we don't routinely use filgrastim after gene therapy to speed up engraftment like we would with stem cell transplant. The use of iron chelators needs to be avoided for up to 6 months post infusion. For patients that get the lentiviral vector transfer gene therapy, they will test positive for HIV on a PCR screen. It's a false positive for the rest of their life. So if they do need true HIV testing, they need to use a non-PCR based screening. And then the FDA does require that these patients are followed for a minimum of 15 years after gene therapy. So, with all the products, it's really analysis of efficacy, durability of these products, but also with the LVV products, there is the ongoing follow-up that includes monitoring for insertional oncogenesis. So, and finally, I just like to say overall that these are really amazing life-changing therapies for the hemoglobinopathies as well as the children who are diagnosed with ALD or MLD. The kids with leukodystrophy, their families receive news that they have a neurodegenerative disease that's going to probably take their life before the age of 10. And now they are alive and well and have a normal life, and they're normal kids doing normal things. And I'm so blessed because I work in clinic and I get to see them come back after 1 year and 2 year and 3 year and just see them being normal little humans that can be great, and are some of them are even to the point where they're starting to plan their college careers. So
I think along those same lines, I think It has been so amazing to be able to be a part of gene therapy and gene editing in this sense, because it totally is changing these patients' lives. Once our sickle cell patients kind of get past that point of going, oh, I'm not going to die when I'm 30 or 35 or 40. So let's plan. Let's make a plan. Let's have life. What can I do now? And we have patients who are now going to college when they thought they would never go to college. We have patients who are able to hold full-time jobs that they never were able to have before. We have patients who are climbing mountains and backpacking through Europe, which would have never been an option before because their sickle cell disease would have prevented them from that. We have patients who are able to be there for their kids. They're able to make a plan. They're able to get married. And it has really changed their lives so much for the better. And I just am really, really impressed with how this process, as you can see, it's not an easy process and it has a lot of steps for the patient to go through. But the reward at the end of it all is totally worth it.
Well, I gotta say, that was truly beautiful. Thank you both so much. And unfortunately, I think, we do have to call it. We've come to the end of our podcast today. So I do want to give again a sincere and genuine thank you to both of you, amazing pharmacists, for sharing all of your wisdom and insights today. And I hope our audience who's tuned in for this collaborative podcast between ASTCT Talks and Oncology on the Go learned many things. I know this was, truly informative and really a fantastic discussion. So thank you both. And with that, we'll call it. Have a great day.
Thank you for tuning into today's episode. We hope you found our discussions enlightening and relevant, offering you a deeper understanding of the present and future of cancer treatment and research. Make sure to join us again for more insightful episodes as we continue to bring you expert opinions and the latest developments from the forefront of oncology and hematology. Please subscribe and leave reviews wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more. For additional resources and episodes, visit our websites at www.cancernetwork.com and www.astct.org.